Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOMP TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. I am your host, whether you like it or not. On today's show, I have the wonderful Shakira. Shakira Jones, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So, Shakira, you are shooting a show called Crush that's coming to SOMP TV, which I am beyond excited about. It is going to be fantastic. And while you were shooting it in Sonoma, you heard this story.
So crazy. So we spent time with Michael Brown of Costa Brown. We were up at Cirque. I mean, one of the most stunning wineries in Sonoma that he is building, this massive house, all these amazing wines. And then, like, as soon as we turn around, we hear that there was a huge burglary there. And all of these, like, large format bottles, library stuff that they haven't even released, that they generally give to, like, charity and stuff, were stolen. And, like, my heart sank.
Well, so it's you called me, you told me this story, and I thought, we have got to figure out how to get him. Now, he doesn't really want people to know this story. So we're going to get him on the line and try to get him to tell the story of how, you know, this burglary. And also, you and I talked about black market and gray market wine off the air. And it's a really fascinating thing. You know, there's counterfeit wine, but then there's also stolen wine. And stolen wine is where a lot of collectors actually get some of these bottles.
Yeah, it's like the awful ecosystem within wine is that the culture of collecting, the whole goal is to have things that no one else has. But there's a really unscrupulous way about how some people acquire these bottles. But it's always crazy to me because it's like, all right, you have it, but if it's stolen and the only way you would have it is if you have one of these stolen bottles, you're setting yourself up to get caught because it's not like anyone's going to sit on their couch and enjoy these wines by themselves. They're going to share it and they're going to get caught. So it's a really weird phenomena, but in the end, it's so heartbreaking and violating to, you know, to people that put so much into these wines to have them stolen.
Yeah, well, so we'll talk about that with Michael here shortly. But first, let's talk about Corvin. You want to talk about Corvin?
Oh, man. I would die without my Corvin. Literally die of alcohol abuse without my Corvin.
Well, today's episode is sponsored by Corvin. And it's a real easy sponsorship for me because this is a device that we now use quite a bit on SOMP TV. If you do not have a Corvin and you are a collector, a sommelier, practicing blind tasting, trying to understand the evolution of wine, or you just have a bunch of bottles that you want to kind of check in on as they evolve, you have to have this thing.
Yeah, it's a lifesaver.
Yeah, it basically what Corvin does is a little needle goes down through the cork and it fills the bottle, it displaces the wine with gas, and it allows you to take a bottle, put it back on the shelf for months, years, days, weeks, and it doesn't you know, it doesn't oxidize. So it's just one of these things where you can, you know, you can take a very expensive bottle of wine of yours. And if you have a tough day, you can have a half a glass of it. And then 6 months later, do the same. So I strongly recommend anyone, if you're listening to this podcast, you should have a Corvin. That's my plug. Now let's get Michael Brown on the line and talk to him about this situation. Shakira, Michael, it is an honor to be here with you two. Michael, I've enjoyed your wine for many, many years under different names and labels and such. So it's kind of an honor to have this come full circle and get you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, great. And Shakira, you just finished up doing a little bit of your Crush episode with Michael.
Yeah, it was great to be out there and see the new facilities and all of that good stuff. We had a great time, so it's nice to chat again.
Did you actually drink any wine?
No, me drink what? No, we had some great stuff, some of Michael's new Cirque wines, which were absolutely delightful. I am excited to have this conversation again and just chat and let loose. So thanks for having me. And hi, Michael.
Hi.
So it's we will talk quite a bit about Crush coming up here, Shakira, your new show that's coming to SOMP TV. It's going to be fantastic. But so, Michael, how do we put you in a place where people who are not familiar understand kind of where you started in the wine business? I think, do we start with Costa Brown? Is that where your story starts?
It actually started in the restaurant business, and then I got into the wine business. And in 97, I decided to learn how to make wine, or tried to learn how to make wine at that point. And Dan and I, Dan Costa and myself, got together and we saved $800 and made a barrel of wine, and then just kept going at it, right? And that's where it started, you know. And I just really had a passion for two things professionally. One, I wanted to be a craftsman, and two, I wanted to have a business, the American dream thing, right? And I figured, well, the wine thing is pretty cool. And we can dive into that if you want to. But as far as how I was inspired by that, and just briefly, it's agriculture. I grew up in a town called Wenatchee, Washington, and it was a tree fruit area. And grew up in cherry orchards and apple orchards and things like that. And then I came down here to California, and I saw these really high-end vineyards that was high-end agriculture. And I saw some wineries that they would take these grapes and make something really brilliant out of it. And then you walk into a barrel room and there's angels everywhere. Everything's living in a barrel room. And it just turned me on. So I said, I want to do that. If it works, cool. If not, I can shake a cocktail and make $60,000 a year. That's my backup plan.
Was there a particular bottle or dinner or whatever that kind of flipped the switch for you that said, I'm going to make this?
Yes. Epiphany wine. And being a sommelier and in the restaurant business, we would taste wines all the time. And we'd go on cannonball runs through Napa, Dry Creek, Alexander Valley, Sonoma Valley. And I just got exposed to a lot of different wines.
But cannonball runs.
Yeah, it was a full-on cannonball run, man. And I'm surprised I'm still alive, actually. But this one day, I worked at this restaurant called Equus back in early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And we would go out with like 30 of us to the Russian River Barrel Tasting, and we'd have a big potluck lunch and stuff. And one day, Margie Williams, Burt Williams' daughter, shows up, and she had some wines left over from a tasting that she had earlier that morning.
I suppose we should jump in and say who Burt Williams is. Burt Williams is it's an understatement to say that this guy is one of the most influential, especially for Pinot, winemakers in California. I mean, William Selyem, you know, I don't mean to cut you off there.
No problem. Michael,
but definitely Burt is I would say an avatar in the California wine space.
He's one of the godfathers, for sure.
Yep.
For sure. And a wonderful person, wonderful person. He's since passed, but he really inspired me. And Margie brought these wines, and it's really hard to find William Selyem wines at that point. And she had about six, and I tasted through them. And at that point, I wasn't really into Pinot Noir because there were a few that were just kind of insipid or kind of light. And I was more into Zinfandels and Cabernets and bigger reds and things like that. And she pulled out this 91 Allen Vineyard Pinot Noir.
Oh.
And I smelled it and I go, whoa, there is something going on here that I've never smelled before. And I put it on my palate. And the only way I can explain it is my head came off my shoulders, spun around and sat back down in a different way. You know, it was an epiphany wine. And I go, I want to make that. I want to do that. And it was very, very inspiring and just a crazy experience, you know, which I had no idea was coming at me.
Yeah, it's that's a proper description of what it's like to be kind of, I would say, conned into the wine world. Because it's happened to all of us. So wait, so you did one barrel. I have to ask this question because I just the fact that winemaking is so expensive and such a pain in the butt to actually make a profit. Did you start with investors and things like that, or did you use this barrel, sell it, make money, and grow? How did you do that?
Well, Dan and I, we'd save $10 a night in tip money every night to buy grapes in 1997. And then we were short like $300. So Jeffrey Madura, the head chef at John Ash at the time, came in and we did thirds. And I go, well, we'll make the wine and we'll split it up a third, third, and a third. And it wasn't licensed or anything, but we had some in the cellar down there. And when cool people would come in the restaurant, we'd kind of qualify them and, yeah, you want to check out something interesting? And then I'd leave the table and I'd come back. Well, what's that interesting thing you were telling about? Oh, hold on. It was a Shiner, you know, no labels, no nothing. And so we're bootlegging, you know, and we'd pour it. And the wine turned out really good. But we didn't have investors except for us at that point in time. And we sold a little bit, you know, on the side here and there. And the next year we made a barrel of Sauvignon Blanc and a barrel of Zinfandel, and both of them were terrible. And then the following year we made 3,600 cases of Lake County Sauvignon Blanc. It's like, what was I thinking? That's a lot of wine.
Oh, yeah.
But we did it and it turned out really good. And then the next 2 years of that Sauvignon Blanc were terrible. But then I said, you know, I wanted to get to Pinot Noir. And that's when we got investors involved. And we put a business plan together and, you know, just tried to raise capital. It was really difficult. But we did it. And we almost went under a couple times. And then the thing started taking off in 2005. And it's a long story, but it worked. You know,
no, I mean, a lot of people look at Kosta Browne as a kind of a big influence wine for them. I know for a fact there's people on our own team who look at Kosta Browne as like a wine that sort of. I know Diane Carpenter, who works with Somme TV. She makes a Pinot and makes a Rosé and looks at you guys as one of the inspirations. So, I mean, it's a weird thing to have that kind of go full circle and have people probably telling stories about your guys' wine.
It's crazy.
And so then you guys, you both sold the brand. Is that correct? Or you got out of Kosta Browne
to start your own project? We sold the brand three times, actually. The first time was in 2009. And I just kept all my investment in the business. And we kept running the business, Dan, myself, and Chris Costello, the three founders. And we had great partners, a private equity firm. And they're still my friends to this day, really good people. And then at the same point, I started CERC because I knew eventually I'd get out of Kosta Browne. And it takes a lot of time to build a brand, right? And so we planted vineyards and a fun little story. My buddy Charlie Chenoweth, who's one of our growers and one of my best friends, back in 08, he goes, Michael, I have this property and I want to plant it. It's an old apple orchard, but I don't have the money for it, but let's figure something out. So I borrowed money from a friend. We got one distribution from Kosta Browne, and I took almost all the money. I put it into this vineyard, and I didn't tell my wife. And she goes, what happened to all of our money? I go, oh, I just bought a bunch of root stock. And that was Bootlegger's Hill, you know, cool vineyard.
Oh, my God. And then are you still married?
I am picturing, like, visualizing this scenario of my husband telling me, yeah, we don't have any money anymore because I bought some rootstock.
Yeah, I took both my hands and covered up a certain place on my body, right?
Smart so, man.
Solid plan.
Anyway, then we got Treehouse, and then we started CERC with a group of investors because all my money was tied up in Kosta Browne. And it's called CERC because I was in a circus when I was a kid. And it taught me a lot about life, practice, hard work, dedication, failure, risk, showmanship, all that kind of stuff.
And was it hard to walk away?
Walk away? What?
Like, was it hard when you decided, like, okay, I'm going to do CERC and that's going to be it? But Kosta Browne had already, like, reached legendary status.
It was because it's like my baby, you know? But it was changing. I mean, it was getting bigger and it was, you know, it was a great path, so to speak. But I really wanted to get back to just small lot stuff, you know? And again, Kosta Browne is still pretty small lot stuff and they're doing a wonderful job. They've got great new owners and Duckhorn and really, really good people running that show. But I just wanted to kind of go back and not be in a hurry and just kind of get back to the craftsmanship part of it. And we're very fortunate now. And as you know, again, you were at the winery and that's ours now. And we can just kind of take it as it comes. And so it was difficult. There was a few years there where it was a little painful, you know, kind of knowing I was going to leave. But it was inevitable. And I knew that. It wasn't detrimental, so to speak, but it was just a psychological kind of a shift, You know what I mean?
Sure.
And then, but I said, I want to make wine, man. I want to make Pinot and a little Chard here and there. And, that's kind of my flavor. And so now we're doing that again and with Cirque and also with Chev, you know?
Well, this is great. I mean, I, Shakira, I'm jealous of you that you've actually had some of these wines. I have not yet. So
they are, you know, what I loved about them is I love when you can taste a wine and it's delicious today, but you get like the phenomenal potential that's in it. When you think about it, like you're drinking it today, but you're like, shit, I really want to taste this 5, 10, 15 years from now. And that's what I got. Like, you know, being around Michael, you get a big sense of his personality. And the wines reflect that in that they're, it's so layered, it's so nuanced. And for years to come, you'll keep learning more and more and more and experiencing more from the wines. They are something.
Didn't we have a 13 when you were out? 13.
We did have the 13. Yeah. That was my favorite one that we had.
Because it got some age on it, you know?
Yeah. And it, you know, it's Pinot is not really ever austere, no matter how young it austere. I'm sorry, my pronunciation. It's never really that assertive. But young Pinot, I think, if you have this idea of what it should be, young Pinot can kind of throw you off. But when we had the 13, like it was rested, like it was comfortable in its skin, and it was starting to express like the true self of the wine, which that sounds like an excerpt from somebody's awful self-help book, but it was true. And that's what I experienced. That 13 was something.
Cool. Yeah. Jason, I really like that wine. And it just, these wines just take time. And to get into that point, we don't rack our wines. We keep them pretty reductive. And with that said, it just takes the wines longer. And people say, when should I drink them? And I go, well, in like 4 or 5 years after release. Start then. But if you have them now, just decant them and it'll be cool, right? But you put it very well. They do relax. And they become more of an adult rather than an adolescent, right?
Yeah.
To use an analogy.
How do you think, though, how do you, as a business plan, you know, where it looks like the market is just, especially here in the States, like people just don't hold wine anymore. Like they buy it and they consume it immediately. And it's not that your wines are undrinkable, but you make them with the idea that you'll rest this for a while and then drink it then. How do you think the market will respond, or what's the response that you've seen to people kind of knowing that they're buying this Pinot? You know, we talked about it, like you're not trying to make Burgundian Pinot Noir in California. You're making your Pinot Noir and expressing the place that it's from. So with those two things, like, how do you think that's received? And like, this is a Pinot that you shouldn't be buying to drink today. If you want to, you can.
For us.
I don't think he's in this to make money, Shakira. I think that's...
Yeah. Clearly.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind getting a brand new Pinto, but anyway, you know, but... It's a really good question. And what we do is we try to message the best we can to our consumers. And most of our wine goes through our mailing list, about 90%. And we, you know, we message saying, hey, lay these down, properly cellared, and you'll be happy. Just forget about them for a while. But if you do have them, decant them. But we suggest you hold on to them for some time. And there's some consumers that talk to me, I can't do it. I can't wait. We're going to open it right away. And I go, well, that's fine. And I hope you enjoy it. But again, hide a couple away and forget about it. You know, just forget about it. And then when you're digging around in your cellar, you know, oh yeah, I forgot about that one. And then crack it and sit down and enjoy it. And so people have their habits on how they, you know, consume wine and things like that. And there's plenty of wines out there that you can just grab off the shelf and they taste great. But again, our wines, they just need some time. But it's not up to me to dictate to our consumers when they drink the wine. We just put out suggestions, right? Here's what we suggest. And we hope you enjoy it either way, you know?
Makes sense. This is a perfect transition into a topic I'm sure you don't want to talk about. I want to set up kind of what recently happened to you and what happened to your winery. But also before we do that, let's talk about gray market wine and black market wine and these concepts. And I don't think people think about it this way, but the luxury wine market, you know, talking about the first growth Bordeaux and a lot of Burgundies and a lot of, things like William Selyem and your wine and you know, a lot of cult Napa wine. Can you tell us how some of that stuff hits the market? Let's figure out a way to jump into this conversation.
Well, there's different ways, you know. And again, yesterday we were talking about Sassicaia, and it was a total fraud thing or counterfeit, but they did it perfectly, right?
Yeah, what happened there, Michael?
You know, I read the article briefly. So apparently there was like 10 people, and they redid all the packaging and all the wine, and then they were selling it. But it was apparently a brilliant effort, but they got busted, right? And so that's just one thing. Another thing is, you know, we used to get, and we still do, people will email us and say, hey, I'm a student from here and there. Can I get some corks and some labels for my project?
Really? Well,
oh, yeah. It's like, no, you can't, right? Because then they can recreate it. And at a certain point, we went through Kodak, and they put this special ink in our labels, and we had a certain reader just to know if it was authentic or not. And we did that for 3 or 4 years, and it's like, whatever, it doesn't make sense. But there are people out there, there's lots of stories about people, you know, just counterfeiting and selling it, and the motive of profit, right?
Yeah.
And it's just kind of a bizarre thing. And it happens in lots of different industries, there's no doubt. But the high-end wine industry, it's amazing that there are enough consumers out there that want these wines. They want them. And there's people out there, I'll give them to you, but it's the fake stuff. It's the fake stuff, you know?
Okay, so what about the stuff that just sort of falls off the truck? You know, I remember being a server. So I was a server for a long time. Mm-hmm. And or at least
me
a long
too.
Time.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, look, the restaurant industry is full of some unsavory people. And I definitely remember wines floating around going, hey, you know, somebody would take a bottle and try to sell it later or something like that. But there's this stuff happens at a much larger scale. Mm-hmm. And I know, unfortunately, you guys are dealing with something now. And I want you to tell me what happened. Give me the story. Okay. And then what are you going to do about it? You know, I'm just curious.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's a bit of a mystery.
I was floored when I heard what had happened and heartbroken because, you know, when people are getting these wines just for profit or bragging rights or whatever, they miss the entire, like, soul of the wine and the winemaker and how these wines were made and how they were meant to be enjoyed. And so it's tremendously heartbreaking. And to know that I was literally just there. So Michael, tell us what happened.
Well, all we know, and again, we've got Scooby-Doo and Shaggy on it because they're really good detectives, right? If you get that joke.
Of course. Right?
they're always stoned. That's the
We're
problem.
Old.
They are. But anyway, last Sunday, you know, about 10 days ago, it was about 2 weeks ago, actually. We came in and we went into the wine room, and it was just all in pieces, you know. And this one little wine room we have, nobody knows where it is. It's a little kind of a secret alcove. But they went through there, they cut the chain, and they rifled through everything. They left certain bottles, but they knew what they were going for. It seems like they did. And they had to get in the property somehow through a gate or some other way or some dirt road. And then they had to know exactly where this room was. They had to have a truck because they stole about 540 bottles, 750s, Magnums, 3 liters, 5 liters. You're right.
Wow.
And I'm like, are you kidding me? And here's the – I reflected on this. And the biggest downer, all these bottles, they're not for sale. We give them to charity auctions, right? And, you know, schools and museums and things like that. That's what we do with these big bottles. And now all of a sudden we can't give those bottles to these charity auctions because some idiot has them somewhere, right? We have no idea who it is, right? for how they got in, how they knew about it. But we're sniffing around, you know. we're not gonna lose sleep over it. We have bigger fish to fry. But it was just a violation. Somebody came into our lair and did this, and I'm like, really?
Well, are you guys gonna like check Wine Searcher? I mean, what is the natural thing? Because 550 bottles of different sizes, you know, these are gonna pop up.
They're going to pop up. And so I made about 30 calls around the country of all the people that I know that are in the circle. And I said, hey, if something pops up, let me know. If I can just find one bottle and trace it, then we're good, right? Because these bottles, again, we don't sell these bottles. And we know where the auction bottles went and who has them and from the past. And we know that we didn't release any of these bottles to auctions yet, right? And so anyway, we're doing just some investigative work, and you know, there's the police are on it and stuff like that. But you never know. I mean, the French Laundry got broken into. Remember that story?
I do.
Somebody ripped the wall off and stole like $1.3 million worth of wine, and they found it all in Connecticut or North Carolina or New York, somewhere on the East Coast.
Yep.
It's so weird though. Like, don't you, for the people that are taking and buying and whatever these wine, it's almost like their ego won't allow them to keep it secret, so they're going to get caught.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's how everybody gets caught. It's just, you want credit for what you did.
Yeah. It's like, why risk this? Because it's not like you're just going to consume it in your house by yourself, right? You're going to have a dinner party or something where it's going to get out there like, oh man, my friend had this bottle of, you know what I mean? So why do this? I mean, why steal anything is the real
question. Well, why does a criminal do what criminals do? I mean, you know what I mean? But what's interesting also is we had all these packed up in really nice shippers and styrofoam and all these, you know, they're all protected. And they left all the boxes and just took the bottles. Like, you idiots, just pack it up in your truck and put a strap on it, man, because they're packaged nicely. And that was another thing. I'm like, wow. Okay, it was an intelligent job. But not so intelligent, right?
Do you guys think that I hate to say that, like, there's an ecosystem that feeds this greed and this desire to just one up everyone and have this bottle that no one else has. And you know, there was a documentary a few years ago that showed like how much counterfeiting is there, and how much the people consuming them actually don't even know what they're drinking. They just want to say that they had this bottle and this vintage. How much of it do you think, like, the wine industry itself feeds into this culture of, like, I have to have this bottle that I know that no one else has?
Or collecting culture, you know?
Yeah, collecting culture, the consumers.
Yeah.
So there's trophy hunters out there, you know, and they want the trophy. And a lot of these trophy hunters, so to speak, and nothing wrong with what they're doing, but do they like the wine, or do they like the label, right? But
that's the same with art collecting or anything, you know.
Exactly.
The people who can afford a Picasso often aren't the people who really appreciate Picasso, you know.
Right. And so anyway, you know, people enjoy wine for different reasons, and I respect it all. And you know, so yeah, there's people out there, and again, going for a trophy, and they want the 100-point stuff, and they want all these different things. But a quick fun story, just real quick. One of my buddies, he had an empty bottle of a Magnum of Screaming Eagle one time, and it was a tasting with a bunch of really high end wine people. And he takes a 04 bottle of Kanzler Costa Brown and pours it in the Screaming Eagle bottle, and he puts it down, and people go, "Oh my God, Screaming Eagle Magnum!" And this is probably, I don't know, 7 years ago or something. And he was telling me the story, and they were all going, "Oh man, this is good. It was Pinot Noir, man."
Oh my God.
And they were all, "Oh my God, this is good. Oh wow, but it's different. There's something different about it," right? And he's just sitting there watching.
Total different.
I wasn't there. But
everybody gives me so much shit, Michael, about doing all these blind tastings and really loving the concept of it. This is the reason people should blind taste every once in a while.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of blind tasting. Big fan. And so, anyway, they finally, after an hour, they kind of caught on. You know, but that's funny. And that's what we do. When we do our blending, we blind taste it. You know, we'll line up all these different things and we'll shake it all up. And because if you know what's in it, you have a preconceived idea of what you're going to think about it. But blind tasting, well, what is this? Whether it's, you know, part of our craft or whether it's a tasting somewhere with a bunch of different people, it's just a fun thing to do. And it opens your mind up in a different way to go, what is this? Where'd it come from? What am I getting off this without knowing the label? You know what I mean? Yeah.
It gives people the blinders game is a lot of fun. And I've played it with a few friends, some with better or more experienced palates than other. I think when people blind, they actually, especially for newer drinkers, they realize how much they do know, right? Versus someone telling you, like pronouncing some crazy producer or, you know, somewhere in France that you've never heard of before. But you know what black cherry smells like, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that when people see, you know, the blind tasting segments on Somme TV or when they play blinders, it helps people realize, like, look, some people are full of shit, okay? You know what your nose smells. You know what you've tasted before. Go with that. And you'd be surprised how much more and how enhanced your wine experience can be if you forget about what's on the bottle and who made it and what vintage it is, and you just learn to hone your senses to enjoy what's in the glass.
Well, and also you won't be duped on a Screaming Eagle being a Pinot. But so, Michael, I have a couple questions for you. I don't know how uncomfortable they are, but it sounds to me there's a pretty good chance that this is somebody you know who did this, right? I mean, how else could it be? This is not a random drive-by situation here. What are you going to do if it turns out to be someone you know?
Well, what I want to do is do a little Mike Tyson, but I'm not going to do that. So I don't know. That's like,
do you think it's someone you know?
I don't think so. I think it's somebody maybe from the past that maybe knew somebody, and somebody might have said, "Hey, there's some good stuff in here," right? It's a mystery right now. It's really hard to figure out. And so,
keep going.
Oh, so what are we going to do about it? You know, we're going to, like this morning, we got a new security thing set up on that room and everything. And we got cameras up and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just, again, it's like somebody burglarizes your house. What are you going to do about it? Right. It's like you got to go, man, they stole some cool stuff out of my house and that sucks and I was violated. But are you going to lose sleep over it and go search around and all these different things and try to find these people?
Yes.
Well, we have sniffers out everywhere, right? And, you know, I'd like to find out who did this, but then what do you do? It's like, okay, cops.
Here's you hire Liam Neeson right? And he goes out like the skills. And he breaks some skulls.
I'm thinking the two guys from Pulp Fiction, right?
There you go.
Jules and,
The Royale of Cheese. Anyway. Yeah.
The last question, though, is just, I mean, there's got to be something, and this is a really weird perspective, look at it, though, but that your wine is valuable enough to be taken like this. Meaning there's got to be something to go, okay, look, people collect my wines. They're at a certain level now, and you have to beef up security, but there's some kind of thought that, all right, you know, I make this class of wine. Here's where I am now, right? No?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And again, knowing and seeing what they did and what they took, and they didn't take other bottles, then they knew what they were doing and they know the brand. And it's pretty much all Circ, you know?
Yeah.
And so anyway, it's nice. You know, we do the best we can to provide a good product to our consumers. That's the main thing. You know, and some people love it and some people it's not my bag, whatever. It doesn't really matter, but we've got enough people that enjoy our wines, which we're, you know, it's humbling actually. And we're just trying to do better every year. That's all we're trying to do. You know?
That's great. So Shakira was up there with you during the first round of fires recently.
Yeah.
Which seems like 8 years ago, considering what's been going on. I don't want you to talk too much about the fires, but what I do want you to talk about is the future and kind of where you're going and what's happening up in especially Sonoma. What's What's the future hold for you, and what are your thoughts on the current situation? There's a lot of doom and gloom up there right now.
Yeah, you know, there's blue skies today. It's really pretty, and the fires are almost contained. But yeah, it was pretty brutal. We lost about 80% of our fruit. There's some producers that they didn't harvest anything, right? Smoke taint and stuff like that. And we're still evaluating, but we're way down, and it is what it is. What are you going to do? Mother Nature, she's in control. And so, in my opinion, there's not a lot of doom and gloom, but leading up to this with COVID and the restaurant shutting down and tasting rooms shutting down, there's a lot of wineries that are suffering, you know, it's really bad, but there's still a lot of people that are buying wines direct, and that's opening up. I know people that are like, oh my God, we're selling so much more wine out our front door through shippers than we have been in our tasting rooms and things like that. So
yeah, yeah,
there might be a silver lining, but who knows? I mean, every vintage is different. Every vintage has, it's a challenge or a blessing, right? And you just got to kind of,
I feel pretty good about, I know it's really tough because I'm not in the position a lot of winemakers are, where there's less tourism happening. There's a lot of issues. COVID is just devastating. But I think, you know, personally, I think if there's any industry I've ever been in contact with that is resilient, it's the wine business. I mean, it is, especially farmers. Farmers yeah. are the most resilient people I have ever, you know, spent time with.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I'm not as negative on the way things are going. And most people I've talked to are pretty positive.
You know, that was probably the most compelling part of the story to tell about being there. It's like, yes, people are losing a lot, but the spirit that's there is like, look, this is what we got. We have integrity and we won't put shit in a bottle to sell for you. But what we do bottle and what we do sell is going to be amazing. And the fires should not be a reason to not buy these wines. And I think that that's the part that everyone will have to remember. And I mean, honestly, considering all that everyone's been through in 2020, I feel like it's going to be really hard to get your hands on these wines because everyone is almost going to want to time capsule like everything mm-hmm. that we've been through in this year. And these wines will be kind of a living, breathing testimony of everything that we've went through everywhere. But that was definitely, and I mean, Michael, your winery is under construction and it is stunningly beautiful. So in the midst of all of this, it was so beautiful to see so much growth, so much building, and so much life still being born in the midst of all of this.
Yeah. You know, there's only one way through it, and that's through it. Right. And progress and things like that. But and you put that very, very well, everything you just said. But the growers and the farmers, you know, a lot of them took a pretty serious hit. Some had crop insurance, some didn't have crop insurance. And they're still working through it to try to shore up because they've already paid their money on farming. And some of them, again, they got nothing coming in. No insurance, no nothing. But Congressman Mike Thompson is working really hard on the WIPS program to try to get some relief, you know. It's like a hurricane. I mean, it's a disaster, right? So hopefully he gets that through and there's some really good people on it and trying to, you know, just shore this thing up because crop insurance will get you about 60%, maybe 65% of your total. They're trying to shore that up. And then with people with no insurance, they're trying to get people up to 70, 80% or something like that, right? So at least these farmers can pay their bills, you know? It's a tough game. It's a tough game out there.
Well, everybody needs to buy Napa and Sonoma wine right now, especially from the smaller guys, you know?
Absolutely.
Support these producers. Well, let's talk about your book. You got to plug your book. Your book is finally coming out. What's it called? What's it going to be about? Where can we buy it?
The title's Pinot Rocks. That's been my email address for like 20 years, you know? And I was kind of convinced to write my story, you know, with James Lauby and then this guy, Tucker Max, who owns Scribe Media, the book company, really good outfit. And it took 4.5 years and we went through it and Tucker Max, he's the founder of this company. And he goes, I'm going to do this myself with you. And we just sat down many, many times and just went through this whole story. And it starts out when I was a kid and you know, high school and restaurant work and my circus stories and then getting into the wine business. And then it really kind of leads up to more of the American dream and business, right? But mainly it gets into the American dream. Like anybody can do it, but it takes a lot of work.
So is it a wine book or an entrepreneur book? What kind of a story is this? I know you're a very funny guy, and I'm assuming this is going to be a pretty funny book. I mean,
oh, there are some wild stories in there, dude. There are some wild stories.
That's what I'm getting at.
Oh,
yeah,
but Jason, there's a bonus too. Who's reading the Audible version of this book?
Oh yeah,
that's right.
So the book company they mentioned, we've got 7 narrators out of LA. They're all really good. You choose whichever one you want. We're going to send you all their stuff and you can hear their tone and everything. And I go, okay, cool. Right. It's all new to me. And then that night I'm sitting there going, well, there's only 2 people I'd want to do this. Morgan Freeman or William Shatner. Right. And I could get to Morgan Freeman. Maybe it would be challenging because I know a person that knows him, but that would be really hard to do. But one of my buddies down in L.A., he's a radio guy, Mike Horn, knows William Shatner. And I called Mike Horn and I said, he runs CRN Radio, really great radio company. Anyway, I said, hey, do you think William Shatner would read my Audible book? And he goes, I don't know, let me call him. And then a week later, he goes, yeah, he likes the manuscript, he'll do it. And the day before he was in studio, he got on a phone call. He was like, yeah, Michael, I like the manuscript. It's really great. And he has a certain tone to his voice. He goes, but the tone of this book is lower tone. So I'm going to lower my tone.
The right? William Shatner School of Acting, yes.
Yeah. And he freaking nailed it. It was really cool. So
when does it come out? When can people get it?
You can pre-order it on Amazon right now. There's a paperback up there, but we've got hardcovers coming out. Kindle is coming out, and then the audiobook. But it's all kind of the week of the 10th of November. But there's there's pre-orders on Amazon and things like that. I think it's on Google. But anyway, there's a big push by this company to get it out there. But it'll all be kind of set and ready early November. But
that's so awesome. There are so many stories in there. I mean, even the time that we spent together, the circus stories alone, I mean, all of it is just going to be entertaining as hell. I can't wait for it to come out.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Michael, it's an honor to talk to you. Sorry you had to talk about some of the hard stuff, but,
cool.
We should do this again over a glass of wine and a shot of tequila.
I'll pass on the tequila, but I'll make sure
get plenty. No passing on tequila, man. You gotta do it. Jason and I are a bad influence.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, hey, I really appreciate you having me on. Really good stuff. And you guys are doing some wonderful, amazing things. And yeah, it's really neat. I love the food and wine aspect. And, you know, it's multidimensional Somm TV. And it's just a really neat thing. So, I appreciate you having me on. And we'll keep on keeping on.
We appreciate it. Thanks, Michael. Well, behave yourself and we will talk very soon, okay?
Sounds great, brother. All right, thanks.
Michael.
All right, thank you.
Bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Somm TV podcast. Do not forget to go to SommTV.com. Right now, it's $49.99 for the year, and the holidays are coming up. You can gift it, and you should have it anyway if you're a listener to this podcast. And tune into Shakira's podcast, A Glass for Every Palate. Please make sure you rate and review this podcast and hers. Shakira, you got anything you want to plug?
Listen, I'm going to echo Corvin and also Blinders. That game is so much fun. And if you all, like, kind of everyone's got a hidden bottle or you send your bottles, there's so many retailers now that'll wrap the bottles for you and hide them. It's a great way to make virtual get-togethers fun. So definitely, if you are looking for ways to connect with your friends and have a little fun with your wine, make sure you have a deck of Blinders.
Blindersgame.com. Good stuff. Hey, you're a good plugger. All right, Shakira, till we talk next time. Thanks for doing this today.